The court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Rule 3-1391, Menard Inc. v. Lightway Lighting Products. We have arguing on behalf of Menard, Webster A. Hart. Mr. Hart.
May it please the court, I am Webster Hart from Eau Claire and I represent the petitioner Menard Inc. There are three points that I wish to make in my argument, and they relate to the Uniform Commercial Code, permissive counterclaims, and fairness and due process. The problem that was created by the Court of Appeals decision in this case is that it has, number one, the effect of substantially changing the relationship between buyers and sellers under the Uniform Commercial Code. And secondly, it's in complete conflict with this court's decision in the case of National Operating versus Mutual Life Insurance Company, in that the National Operating case clearly set forth the distinction between Uniform Commercial Code rights and contract rights, and the Court of Appeals basically in its decision ignored the National Operating case.
I have one question, counsel. And having, I read through this, I read the complaint and the late answer that Menard served a couple days late. In that, now, should we even take into account that answer at all? I'm talking about in the first Lightway case where they received, the judgment, default judgment. I'm talking about that answer.
I understand that. And based upon the Court of Appeals decision, I would say you should not take that into consideration. We have the benefit of 20/20 hindsight in this case because of the subsequent trial. And I will get into that. But from the standpoint of the answer, a default is a situation where there is no answer. And accordingly, if you're going to use the principle that says that the case is restricted to what has been pled in the complaint, then it would only be the complaint that you would consider in determining whether or not there should be claim preclusion.
And the only reason I brought it up is because in the transactional analysis, could it have been brought within the first lawsuit? It just seemed to me that the Court of Appeals, I won't, right or wrong, but they tried to place it in that transactional situation. In other words, whether you could have brought it isn't important. What you're saying, because of the UCC, because of perhaps your argument on permissive and the fairness, right?
That's correct.
That's
correct. Wisconsin is a permissive counterclaim state. We know that. There aren't that many states that are, but we have a situation where a counterclaim does not have to be raised. When a judgment is entered by default, however, there is no opportunity to determine whether a counterclaim would have been barred in a subsequent action by claim preclusion, and that's basically Justice Wilcox's question relates to that. We don't analyze the answer in determining whether or not claim preclusion would apply.
The complaint was filed in this case.
I'm sorry?
When the complaint was filed, and you had an opportunity to answer, did Menard know that that there were defective lights, defective lighting fixtures?
The parties have been doing business for over 6 years, from 1993 until 1999. This is not a single transaction where there was a purchase order for one or two goods. The goods were delivered and later were rejected. Acceptance was rejected. This was a relationship that had existed for 6 years and involved over $18 million worth of purchases. There were purchase orders invoices, payments against invoices, revocation of acceptance of some goods, return of those goods, and an important point, an invoice then to Lightway for goods that had been returned. In other words, the parties, although Lightway sued on a contract claim, the parties acted in accordance with the Uniform Commercial Code because they followed the procedure for acceptance and then subsequent revocation of acceptance. And the reason that that's important in the relationship between these two parties is because Menards is a large retailer. Lightway is a large manufacturer. And in today's climate, it's necessary for manufacturers to take back goods that have been rejected either by the buyer, Menards, in the case where the goods come in and are obviously defective or broken, or in the case when customers subsequently return them. In answer to your question, Menards knew that that there were goods that had been rejected and for which Lightway had been invoiced. And quite frankly, that's one of the reasons that this case went by default. The parties had ceased doing business in 1999. And then they attempted to reconcile the relationship. They were in the typically this is done by the purchasing agent at a large company and the sales personnel from the vendor. And efforts were continually being made to resolve these issues. There's no indication in either the plaintiff's complaint, in Lightway's complaint, that there were specific goods that were represented by those invoices that had in fact been returned for credit. The returns, after revocation of acceptance, were something that had occurred over the course of dealing.
Mr. Hart, is it your position here that this was a situation where claim preclusion is not applicable because there is not an identity of claims?
Yes.
Right. Could you amplify your position?
This is and I rely on the national operating case for this purpose. The Uniform Commercial Code sets forth specific separate rights of sellers and rights of buyers. They do not intend, because this is we all know that the Uniform Commercial Code is designed for merchants, people that are accustomed to doing business together, and it's designed to facilitate a common understanding throughout the country and internationally as to what these rules are. And so the first mistake of the Court of Appeals was to say that this was arising out of the same transaction. The Uniform Commercial Code does not permit that, as was recognized in National Operating, a case that did not involve the purchase and sale of goods, but a case that involved a default, a judgment that was taken by default.
Tell me precisely the language in National Operating that you're relying on.
It is not so much the language in National Operating as it is the holding itself.
Right. What's because the holding you're relying on?
That's right. And what the holding does is say that the code provisions relating to rights that the defaulting party had withstood elimination by the doctrine of claim preclusion.
Now, there were two declaratory judgments in National Operating, and the case has been treated that way and distinguished on declaratory judgment. We don't have any declaratory judgments here.
Yes, but we have a default, and I don't think that the fact that it's a declaratory judgment as opposed to a judgment on a default judgment arising out of the failure to answer the complaint has any significance.
Default and declaratory judgment have the same significance. Would you say that a decision on the merits would have the same? Suppose this case hadn't been defaulted. Lightway collected the same amount.
$354,000.
Now your client, Menard, is suing for $140,000, right? What would your position still be? No claim preclusion?
Absolutely.
Okay, so default doesn't have anything to do with it. Declaratory judgment doesn't have anything to do with it either.
Under the UCC analysis, there are two separate rights that, and in addition, there is an unjust enrichment claim.
Tell me where in the UCC the UCC takes precedence over claim preclusion, transaction, et cetera.
Well, I don't know that it specifically does.
Okay. That's what my point is. You're just reading it that way.
Certainly. Okay. And because it makes so much sense. It makes so much sense that claim preclusion would not apply. We can go to my third point, which is the fairness point.
Counsel, before you get to your fairness point, I want to follow up on an area that had been touched upon earlier. As I was preparing for this, I was wondering if there would be a difference between the product that was received by Menards and was impaired or broken or whatever, and product that was subsequently returned by a purchaser because of the problems with the product. And I thought, well, maybe the product that was returned by purchaser would have extended beyond the time of that first cause of action having concluded. And then, you know, it wouldn't have been possible to ask for money back for some of these exchanges from customers. And yet, I note that in paragraph 21, I think it is, of the Court of Appeals opinion, it indicates, indeed, the trial court here correctly concluded that all of these could have been raised in the first action. So to the extent that some of the monies involved in the action where Menards is the plaintiff, were all of those returns from customer returns, were they all finished by the time of the first cause of action having been completed, or is the Court of Appeals wrong, or am I misreading?
This lawsuit took place some time after the parties had ceased doing business with
one another. Which lawsuit? The Lightway lawsuit or your lawsuit?
The Lightway lawsuit.
Okay. So the transactions had been finished. All right. All the
returns
from customers had been made by that time?
We believe so. But it didn't have to be that way, and that's the point. It didn't have to be, because people could bring back product at a much later time and still have the right to have that product returned. Menards, under the Uniform Commercial Code, could still revoke acceptance, because we were dealing with multiple different products that could be in inventory for a period of years, and then sold to customers, or they could have been immediately sold. They could have been delivered to the distribution center in Eau Claire, or they could have been direct shipped to one of Menards' various retail centers. So we don't know that, and the case cannot be determined on the basis of whether or not it was whether or not the refund or the returns for credit had all. We're all in existence.
Just for clarification, then that sentence that I read, indeed, the trial court here correctly concluded that all of these could have been raised in the first action. I didn't go back to the trial court to read that part of the transcript, but if that's a finding that the court made, then it seems like
a finding in the Menard versus Lightway case. Because the issue was raised. Now, we had a summary judgment brought by Lightway first on the claim preclusion basis, and that was denied. And that's what then Lightway has appealed to the Court of Appeals. But then we did have a trial later. And the trial, two different trial judges in Eau Claire, but a trial nonetheless. And the trial court determined they had an opportunity right then and there to say, well, these rose out of the same transaction. Claim preclusion applies, and did not. Judge Stark did not find that to be the case. She found, because we had the Lightway claim, if you look at their complaint, it's based upon contract. nothing in the likely complaint about the Uniform Commercial Code. It's absolutely silent. Menard's action against Lightway is based upon the Uniform Commercial Code and unjust enrichment. So they are, if you use the analysis of ABCG about restricting it, and National Operating as well, about restricting it to the pleadings, there's nothing in the pleadings that Lightway brought that would suggest that this is the same transaction.
So I'm having a little difficulty in just understanding what effect, if we were to find for your position, what effect this would have in people sitting back. I'm talking about in the merchant situation with a supplier, and sitting back and saying, all right, we want to bring ourselves under the UCC, or for whatever reason, certainly it wouldn't be good trial strategy, would it, to let a default be taken and then come in with a claim that could have been brought in the first action?
No, no, that would not be necessarily good trial strategy, but it might be a situation where you were required to do that because your cause of action had not yet fully developed. And we don't want a situation where sellers rush to the courthouse in hopes of getting a default judgment when the parties are negotiating back and forth on various issues, and then hoping that point claim preclusion will prevent any separate relationship or actions that somebody has under the Uniform Commercial Code, for example, from being brought.
And so if we're going to look at your argument under the UCC, and we're going to look at your claim for monies paid back as essentially a revocation of acceptance of these goods, my understanding is you have to do that within a reasonable time, right? Is there any other standard by which you have to revoke acceptance except that it has to be in a reasonable time, whatever that means?
Well, the Code for Revocation of Acceptance has the...
I think it's 4608.
608, revocation of acceptance in whole or in part. The buyer may revoke the buyer's acceptance of a lot or commercial unit whose nonconformity substantially impairs its value to the buyer if the buyer has accepted it. Revocation of acceptance must occur within a reasonable time after the buyer discovers or should have discovered the ground for it before any substantial change in the condition of the goods which is not caused by their own defects. And that of course occurred as soon as the product was returned by customers, or in the case where, and this case really arose out of primarily the packaging process that Lightway used, and Menards attempted to get them to change it to protect their goods because they would come to the stores all beat up, and people simply did not want to buy something that was in a box that was so damaged. And so I think that based on, you know, there clearly has never been raised the issue that the revocation of acceptance was not reasonable.
Now, if you revoke acceptance of goods, you can sue for your price, or you can cover and pay somebody else and then sue for what you had to pay somebody else, right?
Right.
If you take the latter route and you decide to seek cover rather than a direct return of the price, is that something that occurred here at all? Was there any attempt at cover or buying other goods to put on the shelves to replace these that were defective?
No. The Menard way, and I think the way of most retailers of that size, is to have a single vendor source for an SKU, a stock keeping unit, mm-hmm. which whatever happens to be. And if it's a light fixture with a ceiling fan attached, you get it from Lightway, and that's what they do. So cover is hard to do, you know. But we, in fact, in this case, we did accept the goods, and we ended up paying for the goods. And then we rejected revoked acceptance of some of the goods, and we then invoiced them for those goods, and that's the cause of action that we believe that we're entitled to have. And, you know, you take a situation where there's a default judgment, it's bad enough that you get a default judgment on the 46-day, and we know that the law does not favor defaults. The law wants litigants to have their day in court, in part because it's typically not the litigant that caused the default. And so we have a situation where we don't want to encourage defaults. Now, what we're doing here is not only permitting Lightway to have all of the, its claim without challenge, for late delivery, for example, or miscounts, or things of that nature. Lightway got a default judgment for its, based upon its invoices as requested in their complaint, the full value. Menard paid that judgment. To have Menard further penalized.
But isn't that the point I was trying to raise was sitting back and letting the default, and then, as I think the Chief Justice asked, when this all happened, and at the time, if I understood your answer, that you were done dealing, that you had a 6-year relationship, you weren't buying from Lightway anymore, and that these returns or these defective goods were known to you at the time that Lightway brought their.
We believe that we had already invoiced them for all the goods that we had received back. That's correct. But why should Menard be penalized further? Not only do they not have the right to deny the allegations of Lightway's complaint, but by the Court of Appeals decision, they lose their rights under the Uniform Commercial Code that this Court has said are separate. That there are separate rights from the rights that that arise out of the contract. And recall, I had 3 points and my warning light went on, and I'm not sure how much time I got left in it, but.
Mr. Carvin, are you sure that Article 9 isn't different from Article 2?
Well, they're different in the relationship to the issues, but I don't think they're different from the standpoint that the code sets up separate rights of the various parties. I don't think that there's a distinction there. And I guess I've answered your question as best I can. I don't think that there is. But the other point I wanted to make is that we can't let this Court of Appeals decision stand the way it is because it's basically making a compulsory counterclaim state in Wisconsin. That's exactly what it's doing because it's saying you have to bring a counterclaim.
Did you folks try to reopen the judgment?
No. The action was commenced before the stay had been lifted. And the reason for that was the judgment, Judge Wall found initially on that there was no excusable neglect. We looked at this as a separate transaction under the code and therefore sued it out on that theory. So the rules would have been different if we would have appealed on the issue that there was no excusable neglect. That would have been, that was the court's discretion to make that finding. But clearly we believe that we had separate rights and that those rights were something that we could pursue and that claim preclusion would not and should not prevent us from doing so.
How do you reconcile the ABCG case with the statute which basically says that this is a permissive counterclaim state? I think if I remember correctly, yes.
ABCG sets up for us a very, very narrow exception to the. What it does is recognize a common law compulsory counterclaim. And it says, though, that in order for that to apply, because we disfavor the default concept, the only way we're going to permit this is if there's a nullification of what the original plaintiff had obtained as a result of its default. There's no nullification in this case. Lightway sued on the contract on the invoices. Its invoices totaled $354,000 in total. They got a judgment in that amount. Menard had claims for goods that they had revoked acceptance on and had returned to Lightway. Now, Lightway at this point has got both the goods and the, you know, ultimately, even though the judgment may not have been paid by then, they had, in effect, the dollars that they had from. So Lightway ends up with both payment for the invoices plus all these goods. They didn't send them back to Menards. They had relationships that changed from time to time over the course of the 6 years as to what would happen to returned goods. In some instances, Lightway requested that Menard field destroy them. In other cases, they requested that they be returned to Lightway. And this would change depending upon, you know, who was the buyer at the time and who was the salesman for Lightway.
Do you look upon the ABCG case where we talk about a common law compulsory counterclaim as an exception to the statute? I'm having some trouble reconciling the two.
I don't think you get to that because I take it out of claim preclusion at the transactional analysis level. And ABCG already went past that point and then said we're going to add an additional restriction, and that is that it has, because we disfavor claim preclusion in a default situation, we're going to require that it be something that was specifically, not only specifically set forth in the pleadings, but also that there would be no nullification. And there's no nullification here. None at all. Maybe somebody could argue that in a bottom line sense, Lightway had to give back some of the $340,000, but the fact of the matter is that they had Menard's money and they also had the goods that had, for acceptance, had been revoked for them. My time is up.
Chief, if I may.
Justice Butler.
Mr. Hart, you said you take this out at the transaction stage, correct? How do you see this court as defining, or has this court defined, transaction for purposes of transactional analysis?
You know, I don't think this court has defined transaction for purposes of transactional analysis, and I'm not sure it can be defined. The transaction, and that's why it's so difficult in a situation where there's no trial, where we're only looking at the pleadings of the party that won the default. The transaction depends upon who the parties are, the relationship of the parties, what kind of goods we're dealing with here, whether or not it's a situation under Section 9 of the Code, or whether it's a section of the sales between merchants. I mean, these are all things that this court can, you know, could try to define transaction, but I don't think it can. And I think that that's the problem that the Court of Appeals has here, is they did try to without really telling us how they did it.
Well, my problem about the transactional analysis and the UCC analysis is this. If this had been an ongoing relationship, so Lightway sues for up to 1999, but they're still going on, and the returns or refund claim deals with products that come to a Menard's attention after Lightway's suit is brought and after Menard pays Lightway, you can't say it's the same, you cannot say it's the same transaction, because there is no way Menard could have litigated those refunds issue, right?
Right. That's what the Allied Semiconductor.
That's right. I know. And that's the case that's cited on page 19 of your brief. I accept that. In this case, it is finished. So you can litigate everything in that lawsuit. It's possible. And it is a continuing transaction of buying Lightway products, right? Menard, that's what it's doing.
I would not choose to use the term transaction. But
I understand that. Continuing operation of the business, so that's neutral. So you could have brought it. And that sounds like claim preclusion. because you have identity of parties, you have a judgment, and you have a claim or cause of action. And if you look at transaction, it's same parties, same kind of business. And that's different than allied, because in allied, the refund issue, I'm using that term, came up after the first lawsuit was finished or after the payments were made. That's how I would distinguish. Yeah. That's how I would distinguish it.
You may have that same situation here. Some of what, you know, payments were an ongoing thing flowing between Menards.
That's what Justice Bradley asked you, I thought.
But it was done by the time of the lawsuit.
That's right. By the time of the first lawsuit. And that's what the issue is. And I'm having a hard time overcoming that. I'm having a hard time overcoming it, even if I accept under the UCC, you got a seller rights and you got a buyer rights. Because in this case, assuming the facts are as we think they are, they've come together. And you could have brought the whole thing in that one lawsuit.
And that's the difference between a compulsory counterclaim state and a permissive counterclaim state.
Well,
and as long as we're permissive, we wouldn't have had to bring it.
But that's the problem that Justice Crooks has raised with the ABC case. And the court said, gee, you can't undercut. It's a permissive state. We concede that, but you can't undercut a final judgment. I, too, have difficulty with saying that and making that exception. But if you do accept ABC, which is stare decisis, here we'd be undercutting the judgment, too.
I don't agree.
Okay. Because it's default?
I don't agree that it's undercutting the judgment because it's a separate right under the Uniform Commercial Code.
It doesn't act as an offset? I mean, really?
This is not an offset.
Yeah.
Why? What's the difference between a counterclaim and a defense, or an offset, if you prefer?
Well, I guess if somebody wanted judgment on the pleadings in a case where they had made a claim that there was no dispute about, and the other party had a counterclaim, it would not be a defense to the original complaint, and the party could move for judgment on the pleadings without affecting the counterclaim and then try the issue of the counterclaim.
Isn't this a defense? That is, the goods were defective?
No, I don't consider it. No, this is not a defense. It would be if we'd have kept the goods, but we revoked acceptance of them and sent them back.
Okay. Thank you. Justice Fraser.
When the goods were sent back, did Lightway respond to the return of the goods in some way?
In some instances, they reduced, but this would have been over the 6 years, not at the end, but during the period of dealings, they would, because they would then deduct from invoices the invoices that they were, Menards would do would be to send a check, and it would be a check that would have invoices for goods that were returned and then dollars for the balance, and it would be applied to a certain invoice of Lightway's. So they would, the goods, while the parties were dealing with one another, they accepted the responsibility for returned goods. And as I said, changed from time to time the basis upon which the goods would be dealt with, because Menards could, under certain periods of years of dealership, invoice Lightway for goods for which acceptance had been revoked, but then field destroy the goods. That was a part of the relationship from time to time.
When you say this, did Menard just on its own deduct from its invoice, that is, its bill to it, for products returned, or did it wait for Lightway to acknowledge the return and that have it, Lightway reduce its invoice?
The Menards would do it on the basis of a commercially reasonable shipping lot. So, you'd get a fan in from from one store in Bismarck and another, you know, light fixture from another store, and when they got to a commercially reasonable lot, they would ship, they would invoice Lightway and ship those goods back to them.
Did Lightway send a check or just reduce its bill?
They would reduce the bill.
Did Bernard reduce its bill, the bill from Lightway on its own for these returns?
They would invoice them. They would not, but they would invoice them and then include the invoices as a part of
the payment.
Payment.
Got it. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I don't get it here. I had this vision, and maybe I'm wrong, that Lightway has sent all of these goods, and at some point, somewhere in the neighborhood, don't hold me to this, of about $140,000 worth of goods were sent back. Now, did Lightway acknowledge the return of those goods and say, we're going to reduce the bill or we're going to send you new goods, or did they not acknowledge it? Did they say nothing?
This was an $18 million relationship, and so during the period of time when everybody was getting along, they did acknowledge them and accepted the invoices that Menards had issued for return goods.
Is that just one shipment? This is many shipments?
Many shipments. Thousands of shipments.
But when Lightway sued for $300,000+, were there already invoices for the $140,000? I think that's
actually,
in essence, maybe what Justice Prosser is asking.
I think so. But it wasn't $140,000, it was $314,000. The amounts were almost equal. And the trial court then, in Menard versus Lightway, made a determination as to, because of the procedure, without an acknowledgement by Lightway of the account. You know, Lightway recognized the returns, but there was a dispute about the count, and I think that that's, you know, part of the...
But as of the first suit, that dispute was there.
It's my belief, Justice Abramson, is that...
It was there.
It was there.
Just wasn't litigated.
It wasn't litigated.
Okay. Got it, I think.
This wasn't it again.
You can explain it.
I'll be happy to state your cause for the court. And I hope correctly. But we shall see. Attorney Bittner, representing Lightway Lighting. Maybe you can put additional light on the subject.
Intended. May I please court, counsel? My name is Carol Dittmar. I'm from Eau Claire as well, and I represent Lightway.
Today is Eau Claire Day.
If I could just dispel any confusion about the facts that were known to Menard when the first lawsuit was filed by Lightway in October of 2000, it's this. All facts and claims relative to any defense, counterclaim, or offset that Menard had at that time were known to Menard. This case does not involve anything that happened after October of 2000, and again, that's the date of the filing of the first claim. Now, the issue presents itself as one of claim preclusion. Justice Butler had asked Attorney Hart if this court had ever addressed the definition of the transactional analysis in applying claim preclusion. And Attorney Hart indicated he was not aware of any. I happen to have at least two cases, one of which is ABC itself, which the appellate court had quoted at paragraph 11 of its decision, and it recognizes that Wisconsin has adopted the transactional analysis approach. And it quotes ABC, under this analysis, all claims arising out of one transaction or factual situation are treated as being part of a single cause of action, and they are required to be litigated together. Again, the appellate court is citing ABC 184 with 2nd at 481.
Counselor, doesn't that get back, though? We're just arguing about what is a transaction. I mean, was the transaction, these were thousands and thousands of lights. Some were sent back, apparently, because the packager was all bammed up and no one would buy them. Perhaps the light inside was just fine. Others were brought back by customers because the light didn't work. Okay, which transaction is that? Is this the transaction about the light that didn't work or about the package that was messed up? Is it about the first shipment or is it about the 2,000 shipment?
In fact, I see the transaction in this case as the returns, the alleged returns.
No matter what the cause and no matter from what shipment they arose.
That's correct. And as Attorney Hart stated, that there is a whole compendium of returns. And the reason that this lawsuit was instituted by Lightway is because Lightway wasn't buying Menards offsets to its bill. And Chief Justice Abrahamson, again, you had made queries along this line just at the end of Attorney Hart's presentation. Menard, on its own, deducted amounts that were due Lightway, stating it was doing so as a result of the receipt of Justice Rogensack, either damaged goods or returned goods. They made no distinction between the two. And, panel, this is why the lawsuit was instituted in the first place. It was instituted.
Mr. Dittmar, you mentioned the ABCG case.
Yes.
What was the other case?
I'm sorry, it is the, I think I might have been, went off on a tangent. It's the Deprat case, D-E-P-R-A-T-T. It's cited at page 10 of our brief.
All right. And then, as long as you brought it up, I note that the ABCG case cites to Post, I believe.
It does. And then the
Post versus Schwab.
Right. And the appellate court relied on that case as well in determining its transactional analysis at page 5 of the appellate decision.
And both of those cases adopt the restatement second judgments. Section 24, is that correct?
They do.
And as I understand sub 2 of section 24, what factual grouping constitutes a transaction and what groupings constitute a series are to be determined pragmatically, giving weight to such considerations as whether the facts are related in time, space, origin, or motivation, whether they form a convenient trial unit, and whether their treatment as a unit conforms to the party's expectations or business understanding or usage. And I guess when I look at that, and that's what I would like to have you kind of focus on, I see the transaction of sending lights and invoicing, and this is the cost of the lights, this is what you pay for. That makes perfect sense. I've got defective lights. They don't work. I'm sending those back. How does that relate to the series of expectations and what's contemplated and in the same time, space, origin, and motivation based on the party's expectations to the original transactions of the sale of the lights?
And if perhaps we have all gotten this matter way too complicated by separating the sale and the return. I think the dispositive issue, the reason that we're here today, is because of the returns. Lightway sued this out because it didn't buy the fact that Menard had taken $350,000 of offsets against its bill for returns. That's why it was sued out in the first place. And if I can cite the Deprat case, which also refers to the restatement, Justice Butler, it states that the transactional analysis requires the courts to examine the factual basis or the root of a claim, instead of examining the various causes of action that spring from that root. So again, if I look at the returns as the basis of the claim, as the root of the dispute between these parties, it doesn't matter if I call it a breach of contract claim, it doesn't matter if I assert that I have UCC rights, the root of the claim is the returns.
It's not really, Counselor, because without the sale, you've got no right for $1. You have to have a right for the money, so you can't ignore the sales.
And I would...
Without the sales, you're going to sue them for the returns they made only because you weren't paid for the sales you made.
At which Menard took an offset for...
I understand that.
And As the appellate court had held, they held that the sale and the returns were one and the same transaction.
I understand that that's what they did. And, that, of course, that's what's bothering this Court, is whether we agree with that or whether we don't agree with that. What about if Menards had revoked acceptance and sought cover and bought goods from somebody else and paid them twice what they had to pay Lightway for these goods? And you started your lawsuit. There's a default judgment. You get the money for what you invoiced them for, which is what you got the first time around. Menard sues you now for cover on these lights, and they want to charge you twice what you charged them because they said they had it provided in a hurry. That's an available remedy on a revocation of acceptance under the code, and how would that be the same transaction as the, quote, returns? Because they're just seeking cover.
Right. The issue is under claim preclusion, is it a claim that could have been raised in the initial lawsuit? Claim preclusion, if there's an identity of parties and if there's an identity of the claims, it precludes any claims that would or could have been litigated in that particular
action. But the would or could have been is the transactional part, and that's what we're all having trouble with here. It's not just any claim you could have brought, or we have compulsory counterclaims, and the statute says may. We don't have them. ABCG acknowledges that. It's may. It says when it's compulsory, but they're not all compulsory. So if you had some other claims with Menard, maybe they loaned you an employee or back and forth, and you had that claim, you know, there's no reason that would have to be brought because the parties are the same, and maybe you got a judgment against them for the, you know, for something in regard to that. The problem is with the transaction, and my problem, frankly, is with the UCC, because I see very separate and independent rights given under that code for buyers and for sellers, and some of the buyer's rights put the seller out of the loop, like cover. So I don't know how you can collapse. If you want to just say the sale and the return, that seems to fit together. But if you say the sale and the revocation of acceptance, which is what opposing counsel is arguing here, that he seeks cover instead of just a reduction of the price, and he comes after you for twice what you billed him for because that's what he had to provide on cover, I don't see how you can collapse that. And that's a right that comes under Section 4, Subsection 8, just the same as returning the goods does.
Sure. But doesn't that arise from the same? We don't have a cover issue in that particular case.
No,
otherwise,
we don't.
I appreciate your analogy.
Right.
But the issue is what are the facts and circumstances that gave rise to this claim? And if Menards, I'll call Menards their claims because I don't think that we can say something's a counterclaim so this rule applies and something is a defense so this rule applies. We have to take a look. Do the claims arise from the same set of facts and circumstances? Are Menards' claims against Lightway, do they arise from the same set of facts and circumstances of Lightway's claims against Menards?
Right.
And I submit that they are. That all has to do with the return of these goods. In a properly filed answer, Menard could have asserted any of these claims. I agree, Justice, that we are not a compulsory counterclaim state, so there could be Menard could have a claim against Lightway what was totally separate.
Sure, sure.
And that didn't involve these returns, didn't involve these facts and circumstances, and they would not be precluded from bringing that claim. But if there is a claim that is so enjoined or ingrained in the same set of facts and circumstances that give rise to the initial claim, I submit that that is a claim that is covered by the claim preclusion doctrine that Wisconsin courts have adopted.
As I understand your argument, which is not the way I really understood the case, the first lawsuit was a suit by Lightway because it disagreed with Menard's offset.
That's correct.
So, bill had been sent over the course of time from Lightway to Menard. And at the end, after the offsets by Menard, Lightway thinks they still owe $350,000 because the offsets were wrong, right?
Correct.
So this is a whole lawsuit about the buyer's return.
Correct.
And if that had been the original claim here, then if Menard had fully litigated that, it would have said, heck no, $350,000 is the right number. That we return $350,000, well, you brought whatever it is, and we don't owe you anything. Is that the way that might have proceeded if there wasn't a default?
That's correct. And again, Justice Wilcox, I think one of your first questions was, do we take a look at the proposed answer in the first action? Does that have any relevancy to the issue here? And I submit that it does for issues that Justice Abrahams just presented. If we take a look at that proposed answer, it's the same thing. It's a mirror image. In fact, it's a copy of a complaint that was filed in the second action. Now, again, the numbers are slightly different. In the second action, Menard asserted entitlement to 310, not 350. I don't know why we have that disparity, but these entities had been in had some decided discourse before this action was filed, and there is a history in that which was submitted into evidence at the eventual trial, the second claim, about the differences of opinion these people had in calculating and giving credit for these returns. This was an ongoing dispute between these folks.
So it would be wrong, under your theory, to say it's a seller's claim for price originally, and that it's a buyer counterclaim or defense for refund. Your position is that it's a dispute about the buyer's refund all the time.
I don't know that if, but it arises because
it arises because of the sale.
Right. And because Menard unilaterally took the offset.
That's right. And Menard took the offset claiming its right of return.
Right. And then the dispute
arose. So the whole dispute is on the right of return.
That, and the value of the goods that were returned.
Okay.
And that was over the course of the dealing. We'd call it this relationship. We won't use the word transaction. But in other words, this had been going on for 6 years, and this involved the entire course of that, or maybe part of the dealings might have been settled out. But in other words, these returns were from these so-called thousands of transactions.
I don't know if it's correct to state the returns were from thousands of transactions.
Well, all the transactions between the parties.
Right, and I also don't want to represent that the parties had an acrimonious relationship throughout the entire 6 years. I think the first couple of years went fine. It's only in the last couple of years that things went south, and because Lightway was disputing the accuracy of the offsets that were being taken by Menard.
So this is a dispute about offsets.
Now,
The UCC applies nationwide. The restatement of judgments is a general statement that could apply nationwide. Most states have compulsory counterclaim. Is that correct?
Yes. I understand we're in the minority.
So Wisconsin has permissive counterclaim. Why, in a statement with permissive counterclaim, should we be treating claim preclusion under the restatement exactly the same way as a state with a mandatory or compulsory counterclaim?
Because even though Wisconsin has a permissive counterclaim statute, there are some claims that are so ingrained in the initial action that they have to be given or they have to be precluded under the claim preclusion doctrine. That if Wisconsin was not to recognize claim preclusion, any judgment would be up for grabs. Anybody could say, all right, I'm going to assert some defenses here because Wisconsin is not a compulsory counterclaim state.
In other words, there'd be no claim preclusion.
Right, and default judgments would also be a nullity because parties could come in. Now, default judgments, are default judgments fair in and of themselves? I will let that to more learned minds. But under the law in the state of Wisconsin, if a party defaults, the court has the discretionary authority to order a default, and if that occurs, the defendant can no longer contest liability. And in fact, for whatever reason, I've had to deal with a number of default judgment situations in a variety of contexts. And pursuant to statute 806.02 sub 4, if there is a liquidated claim, typically a contract claim, where the plaintiff says a certain amount is due, then the clerk shall enter a judgment in favor of the plaintiff upon proof of service and failure to answer. And I have been told by a variety of courts this means that a defendant in that context or situation is not entitled to a damages hearing. They can no longer contest the amount that's asserted in the complaint. And what has happened here is because of the procedural machinations of this particular claim, Menard has been given a damages hearing, contrary to the dictates of the statutes. I also submit that that's probably why Menard didn't appeal the initial default judgment and chose this tactic in an attempt to have another kick at the damages claim.
Ms. Dittmer, the Court of Appeals decision indicates that one of the factors that you look at in regard to whether or not to apply claim preclusion is fairness. And in regard to fairness, I'm having some trouble with that here. You've got a situation where you now have a court that has looked at all of these facts and said, gee, there's about $140,000 that Menards is entitled to. And if you're correct, and if the Court of Appeals is correct, then they don't get that $140,000. Does that appear to be fair from your point of view?
I have a couple of comments on that.
Okay.
First of all, the appellate court at page 12 of the decision and page 29 states that claim preclusion does have fairness as an essential principle and must never be applied to deprive a party of an opportunity for a full and fair determination, as you had indicated, Justice Crooks. It then went on, however, to state that Judge Wall gave these guys 10, 11 months to try to figure out their differences. They failed to do that. And essentially what Menard was doing was simply trying to relitigate the initial situation and said, nope, enough is enough, you guys. I'm ordering the default. And it basically recognized the concept that was found in Statute 806.02 sub 4, I might have miscited that before, that if there's a liquidated amount set forth in the complaint, the clerk shall enter judgment for that amount. There's no discretion in that regard. Now, is that fair? Is that statute fair? I personally may have some difficulties with that, but that's a statute. And we're not in the legislature right here, and we can't change the effect of that statute.
But we can apply the doctrine of fairness. That's something we're to look at in regard to the question of whether or not we should apply claim preclusion.
And
why is this fair?
One of the things that Menard has argued is that they have these separate UCC claims
mm-hmm.
that shouldn't be subject to claim preclusion. In fact, that's one of their main arguments. But the trial that eventually was conducted in this matter didn't try those UCC claims. All we talked about in that trial, both Attorney Hart and I were there, was the correct value of these returns. It didn't talk about any UCC rights that Menard had. In their brief, they cite Section 402.709 that if a seller has obtained the full price of a product, then the seller has to hold the goods for the buyer. And if the seller sells the goods, then they have to account to the buyer for that resale price. None of that was tried. But none of that was even discussed at the trial. Menard never asked for these goods back. Never did they bring any sort of a replevin action. In fact, they gave them back to us.
Well, why would they want them back if they're defective? I mean, that's kind of a silly thing to ask them to do, isn't it? I mean,
right.
That's the whole problem here. I think what's bothering Justice Crooks is all parties seem to have had this issue adjudicated that $140,000 of goods were defective. Why is it fair to tap Menards for that under the doctrine of claim preclusion? I think that's what he's concerned about.
Sure. Because the defense is one that should have been raised in the initial action. If the trial court had found for claim preclusion and we were up here today, we would never have that factual finding. Because of the oddities of the situation, we happen to have an actual trial on the issue. And I Do I personally have some, as I said, some difficulty with applying that statute in a default situation that you've got to pay the full amount of the claim no matter what without a damages hearing? I do. But that's what the statute applies or calls for. So we have a default for $350,000. Now, we eventually went to a trial where defenses, which I submit should not have been tried, but defenses were tried, and I was unable to convince the court that we were entitled to the full $350,000, but that we did have to pay $140,000.
But didn't you get the $350,000? My understanding was the judgment was satisfied.
It was, and I didn't mean to mislead. What I'm indicating is the value of the returns. You know, they understand that Menard was asserting that the value of the returns were in excess of $300,000. And we eventually went to trial and determined that, no, it was only $140,000.
And what you're saying is that you should have and could have gone to trial in the first case on exactly the same issue.
That's correct.
That's your identity of claims.
I think even Attorney Hart and I agree that in a properly filed answer that these claims could have all been disposed of in one case.
And in terms of fairness, I suppose your argument is there was a default. The judge found it fair to continue that default because it refused to find excusable neglect.
Correct?
Therefore, you have a final judgment. And fairness includes a concept of finality.
That's correct. And if I may be so bold as to indicate that there was a recent law review article on state law compulsory counterclaims happened to come out in October, just after we filed our brief. It's a law review article out of Notre Dame. It's 79 Notre Dame Law Review, 1745, titled Common Law Compulsory Counterclaim.
What's the page number?
1745. And it's entitled Common Law Compulsory Counterclaim Rule, Creating Effective and Elegant Res Judicata Doctrine. But I did want to point out one comment in this article to the panel because it ties into Chief Justice Abrahamson's finality issue. And I quote, it says, finality is not just an efficient policy. It is a necessary condition for the existence of a judiciary. This thus emerges the intuitive principle of claim preclusion, that a valid and final judgment generally precludes the defendant from later asserting mere defenses to the claim. And I submit that that is what's happening here, is that all Menard is doing is asserting defenses to this claim. And those are defenses which should have been brought in the first claim because they were not, and it happened to be a default judgment. Menard cannot now collaterally attack that initial judgment. So for those reasons, I request that this Court affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals.
Would you, anything about the Court of Appeals decision you don't like? I mean that seriously.
The one thing that I am struggling with is I, quite frankly, am having difficulty distinguishing between claim preclusion and common law compulsory counterclaims. It seems that they're one and the same thing. I haven't seen a decision issued by the Court which discusses those separately, and I cannot conceive of a situation where you would not find claim preclusion, but you would find a compulsory common law counterclaim.
Is it your position that this case could be addressed just on, from your point of view, just on the standard elements of claim preclusion without getting to discussion of compulsory counterclaim?
Yes, it is.
What's the difference between statutory compulsory counterclaim and common law?
The existence of a statute. I think Wisconsin's
position is that we have common law compulsory.
Yes, pursuant to the decision in ABC, it is indeed my position that common law compulsory counterclaim has been recognized in the state of Wisconsin. In fact, in that law review article, it indicates that they only found 21 cases talking about common law compulsory counterclaim, and 17 of them are out of Wisconsin or the Seventh Circuit.
Seventh Circuit, Wisconsin cases.
I don't know that it said Seventh Circuit. It said Seventh Circuit.
Fine. I'll check it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hart, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. I have great respect for Ms. Dittmer, but I do object to her citing something that has not been included in her brief and not been furnished to counsel, as this court has set forth in its instructions, needs to be done. There are a couple of things about her argument that seem a little bit disingenuous to me. Number one, she wants this court to consider the proposed answer that Menard filed in the Lightway versus Menard case, but she does not want to consider what the trial court found in the Lightway versus, in the Menard versus Lightway case. If you're going to consider what a proposed answer would have said, you ought to also consider what the trial court determined after a full determination of the evidence. The complaint by Lightway versus Menard mentions nothing about the Uniform Commercial Code. It mentions nothing about credits. And in fact, the $354,000 in their complaint does not give any adjustment for any credits. In the trial that occurred before Judge Stark, however, Lightway did indicate that they recognized that their claim would have to be reduced by product that had been returned to them and for which they had been invoiced by Menards. What happened in the Court of Appeals misinterpreted what had occurred during that period of time after the default judgment was entered by Judge Wall. Judge Wall had encouraged the parties to sit down and make a determination as to these hundreds and hundreds of invoices and other documents that related to the relationship here. Lightway refused to acknowledge any of the credits or for return goods for rejected a product. They believed that they had a default judgment on the issue and that that was not something that they had to address, and they were only willing to look at whether or not there was any mistakes in the invoicing that they had done, which totaled the $354,000. You can readily understand that we could not get together under those circumstances because Menard looked at a situation where we had a valid claim for goods that had been rejected, the acceptance had been revoked, and they had been returned.
Counsel,
yes.
I'm reading Judge Wall's decision after the almost year hiatus, and in the decision he indicates several things, but what strikes my mind is he says philosophically he's against default judgment because it seems like it's unfair, but the law says if you're late you enter default judgment unless there's excusable neglect, and you can't find anything that's excusable here is the way that I read it. Then he continues on, it's only three pages, but at the end of the three pages in sum, he says, almost 1 year has passed since this case was filed. It did seem harsh to this court to grant the damages requested by Lightway without giving Menard some opportunity to resolve the controversy. In the 11-plus months which have passed, Menard is still trying to litigate the dispute by raising various defenses and claims. Lightway's original complaint contained a specific damage claim in the amount of, and after Menards was served, it was on notice of what that amount was, and then it makes reference to cases cited by Menards, and then for these reasons. So it seems like a read of Judge Wall's three-page decision is he was concerned about entering a default judgment. He wanted, in a sense of fairness, to give parties an opportunity to work things out. From the way that he perceived it, after 11 months, Menards was still trying to litigate the initial issues and defenses, and then he just called it over with. I don't know if any called it over with is
exactly the way he said it, but in effect what he did. Did I read of that 3 pages incorrectly?
Well, you didn't read it incorrectly, but there wasn't the full story. He also knew that Menards had brought a separate action for its rights under the Uniform Commercial Code. And he concluded that he wasn't going to get this thing resolved within the framework of the Lightway versus Menard case, so that, you know, let the parties make the determination, let some other judge make the determination in the Menard versus Lightway case. So basically that's what he did. And the reason that it took this period of time was that, as I said, we had a principle that we didn't seem to be able to climb over, and that was that Lightway believed that they had basically won the right for us not to have a claim for the goods that we had returned. That was the problem with getting the thing resolved. And so
what you're saying is outside of what he has written here.
I know that.
Okay. I just wanted to be sure that I wasn't missing anything, but what you're indicating is outside of the 3 pages.
After, I don't recall what was the date of his decision?
Sure, easy for you to say. The 9th of October, 2001.
Right, and the complaint in Menard versus Lightway had been filed in August of that year. So, and he was aware of that.
Thank you, Mr. Hart.
Did I lose all the rest of my time?
Yeah, well, Mrs. Bradley
used it well and wisely.
Thank you, and thank you, Attorney Dittmar, for your arguments on the interesting and troublesome issue of claim preclusion and the UCC. That concludes our hearing on 03-1391, Menard, Inc. versus Lightway Lighting Products. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45, and the court will meet at 4 in the conference room. Thank you. We are in recess.
At 4?